You a name?
No.
But you ran the story anyway.
Well, isn't it true?
Anderson is trying to sound pugnacious. Isn't this Coughlin the guy you're looking at for the murder of the girl?
Mr. Anderson, I think I'd better come see you in person, Davis says.
Oh, God,
he says, sounding younger than ever. What time would be convenient?
I guess I could be at the office. There now. Have you got the address? We're in Cathcart.
I have it.
Truth is pretty much a one-man operation.
Just tell me one thing, ma'am. Did I break the law when I printed his name?
Not to my knowledge, Davis says. It wasn't illegal, just shitty. I'll be by this afternoon.
46.
Danny doesn't know what his next stop will be. Maybe Denver, maybe Longmont, maybe Arvada. But after nearly 3 years in Oak Grove, his two small suitcases won't be enough for the belongings he means to take. He decides to go to Manitou Fine Liquors and see if he can get some empty boxes for his clothes. They might not know his face there, because even in his drinking days he stuck mostly to beer. He opens his trailer door shortly after noon and stops on the top step. Darla Jean Richardson has set up her dollhouse on the asphalt in the shade of the Oak Grove office building. It's a big one, damn near a mansion. Carrying it from her trailer must have been a chore. Becky ordered it from Amazon for DJ's 7th birthday, then threw up her hands in despair when she realized it had to be assembled. Danny put it together with DJ handing him the various components, both of them singing along with the radio. That was a good day. She's 9 now, and he hasn't seen Marigold's dream house for almost a year. He supposes she plays with it in her bedroom, or has outgrown it. But if she lugged it all the way out here from her trailer, it can only have been for one reason.
Hey, DJ, what do you say?
It's always been good for a smile, but not today. She gives him a solemn look. She's gone, if that's why you were staying inside. Danny doesn't have to ask who DJ's talking about. Ella Davis was in the park earlier, knocking on doors and talking to anyone who was home. He expected her to make a visit to his trailer, but she never did. Just took off her COVID mask and left.
Where's your mom?
She had to take Mariel's shift at the diner. Mariel's got impetigo. DJ says the word very carefully, syllable by syllable. She said I could stay on my own and she'd bring me back a slice of cake. I don't want cake. I don't care if I ever have cake again. She told me I couldn't knock on your door, so I came here, so I'd see you when you came out.
Danny goes down the steps, walks half the distance to DJ, then stops. The dollhouse is open on its hinges, and he can see Barbie and Ken inside, sitting at the kitchen table. Barbie sits with her legs stuck awkwardly out because her knees don't bend very well. There was a time when DJ and Danny discussed this and other unrealistic attributes of various dolls, plastic skin, creepy hair, at some length.
Why are you just standing there? DJ asks.
Because he can feel eyes, of course. The accused killer and the defenseless little girl. Most people are at work, but some are at home, the ones Inspector Davis talked to, and they will be watching. Maybe he shouldn't care, but he does. Before he can think of a reply, she says,
Ma asked if you ever molested me. I know what that means. It means stranger danger. And I said Danny would never molest me because he's my friend.
Darla Jean starts to cry. DJ, Jesus, don't...
You didn't kill that girl, did you?
Not a question. Fuck the watchers. He goes to where she's sitting and squats down beside her. No, they think I did because I had a dream of where she was buried, but I didn't kill her. DJ swipes an arm across her eyes.
Ma says I can't come over your trailer anymore and you can't pick me up at school anymore. She says they'll either arrest you or you'll go away.
Are they going to arrest you?
They can't, because I didn't do anything wrong.
Are you going away?
I have to. I don't have a job, and most people don't want me here anymore.
I want you. What if Ma decides she wants Bobby for a boyfriend again? He can't fix the car if it busts. I hate him. He sent me to my room once without my supper, and Ma didn't stop him.
She begins to sob and double-fuck the watchers. Danny puts an arm around her and pulls her to him. Her face against his shirt is hot and wet, but okay. More than okay. She won't have Bob back, he says. She knows better. He has no idea if this is true, but hopes it is. He's never met his predecessor. For all Danny knows, he could be a skinny, bespectacled accountant who gets a kick out of sending little girls to their rooms. But he imagines a big hulk with a crew cut and lots of tattoos. Someone a little girl could really be scared of.
Take me with you, DJ says against his shirt.
Danny laughs and gives her dark blonde hair a scruff. Then they'd arrest me for sure. She looks up at him and gives him a tentative smile. That's when Althea Dumfries comes out of her trailer.
Let loose of that child, she shouts. Let loose of that child this minute, or I'm calling the police.
DJ shoots to her feet, tears still streaming down her face.
Go fuck yourself! Go fuck yourself, you fat bitch!
Danny is horrified, but also admiring. And even though he's sure Darla Jean just bought herself a whole boatload of trouble, he can't help thinking that he couldn't have said it better himself. 47. Ella Davis didn't think they made burgs like Cathcart anymore, even in dead red central Kansas. It's a dusty one-stoplight town about 40 miles north of Manitou. There's a quick shop across from the rusty water tower. Welcome to Cathcart, where all lives matter, is printed on the side. Davis buys herself an RC and grabs a Plains Truth from the rack by the cash register. Danny Coughlin has made the front page, sandwiched between an ad for Royal Tires and one for the Discount Furniture Warehouse, where every day is sale day. The headline reads, Suspect claims it was all a dream. Davis cranks up the AC in her car and reads the story before heading down Main Street. It's Peter Anderson's byline. Excepting local sports, Anderson seems to write all the Plains Truth stories, and Davis doesn't think the New York Times will be calling him anytime soon. If Anderson's intent was irony, he fell far short, achieving only a kind of lumbering skepticism. Perversely, it makes her want to believe Danny's version. She tosses the miserable excuse for a newspaper behind her. Plains Truth is on the street-level floor of a white-frame building halfway down Main Street. It's squeezed between a Dollar Tree and a long, defunct Western Auto. It needs paint. The boards are loose, the nails bleeding streaks of red rust. The door is locked. She cups her hands to peer through the window and sees one large, cluttered room with an old desktop computer presiding over it like an ancient god. The chair in front of the computer looks new, but the rest of the furniture looks like it was picked up either at a yard sale or on a dump-picking safari. The long bulletin board is drifted deep with ad mock-ups and old copy, some of it yellowed and curling with age.
Hello, 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 are you Davis?
She turns to behold a very tall young man, perhaps 6'7" or 6'8". He's as skinny as a playing card. He's also strikingly pale at a time of year when most Kansans have at least a touch of tan. A Hitlerian forelock of black hair hangs over one eye. He brushes it back and it flops back down.
I am, she says. Hold on, hold on, I'll unlock.
He does so and they step in. She smells air freshener and beneath it a ghost aroma of pot.
I was down street to see Ma. She's got the diabetes. Lost a foot last year. Would you like a cold drink? I think there's some in the...
She holds up her bottle of RC.
Oh, right, right. Okay, great. As for snacks, I'm afraid the cupboard is bare. He laughs, titters, actually, and brushes away the forelock. It promptly falls back. I'm sorry it's so warm in here. The air conditioning's on the fritz. Always something, isn't it? We roll the rock. Sisyphus and all that.
Davis has no idea what he's talking about, but she realizes he's scared to death. Good. I didn't come here for snacks.
No, of course not. Coughlin. The story about Coughlin.
Two stories, it turns out.
Two, yes, right, okay. As I sit on the phone, I thought I was getting information from someone on the inside of the investigation. A policeman. In fact, he said that. KHP, he said.
Not KBI? The Kansas Bureau of
No, no, he was from the Highway Patrol. I'm sure, totally sure, positive.
The forelock flops. Anderson brushes it back. He also gave you the information about the dream?
Yes, sure did. Absolutely, even suggested I withhold that for my next issue. He said I'd still be scooping the regular newspapers. I thought that was a very good idea.
Do you usually take advice from anonymous tipsters, Mr. Anderson?
He gives the unsettling titter.
Davis could more easily envision this man killing Yvonne than Coughlin. In a TV show, he would turn out to be a serial killer with some strange alias like The Reporter.
I rarely get tips, Ms. Davis. We're basically an ad-based
Inspector Davis, she corrects, not because she's in love with her title, but because she wants him to remember who has the hammer here.
Asking again, did I print anything that wasn't true, Inspector Davis?
I'm not at liberty to say, and it's not the point. Although what you did was so irresponsible that I'd have trouble believing it if I hadn't read it myself.
Now, that's a little...
I don't suppose you have a recording of this mystery call, do you? She doesn't hold out much hope of that. He gives her a wide-eyed look and another unsettling titter.
I record everything.
She thinks she must have misheard. Everything? Really? Every phone in?
I have to. This is a shoestring operation, Ms. Inspector. I also work part-time at the lumberyard outside of town. You must have passed it on your way in. Wolf Lumber?
She can't remember if she did or not. She was thinking about Jalbert. She gestures for Anderson to go on.
While I'm out at the yard, or seeing to Ma, she takes a lot of seeing to. Every call I get, most of them are about ads, but some are from Herd Conway, he does the sports, are recorded and zipped directly up to the cloud.
You don't erase them?
He titters. Why would I bother? Plenty of room on the cloud. Many mansions, as the good book says. My soul hath elbow room. Shakespeare. Our setup might not work for a big city newspaper, but it's fine for us. Here, I'll show you.
Anderson wakes up his computer and types in a password. Davis is far from a compulsive neatnik, but the desktop screen is so littered with icons that looking at it makes her eyes hurt. Anderson mouses to the phone icon and pushes it. A message blares from speakers on either side of the room. He winces and turns down the volume.
You have reached Plains Truth, the voice of Central Kansas and the best buy for your ad dollar. We are a free news and sports weekly, sometimes bi-weekly, that is given out free of charge in over 6,000 locations in 6 counties.
If that's true, I'll eat my shorts, Ella thinks.
If you have news, press 5. If you have a sports score, press 4. If you want to report an accident, press 3. If you want to place an ad, press 2. If you have a question about rates, push 1. That's 5 for news, 4 for sports, 3 for an accident report, 2 to place an ad, 1 for rates. And don't worry about getting cut off.
There's the titter she's coming to know all too well.
This is Plains Truth, where the truth matters.
Anderson turns to her.
It's good, don't you think? All the bells and whistles. Bases covered.
Under other circumstances, Davis, curious by nature, might ask Anderson how much ad revenue Plains Truth generates, but not under these. Can you find that anonymous call?
Yes, sure. Tell me the date I'm searching for.
She doesn't know. Try between June 30th and July 4th. Anderson brings up a file.
That's a lot of incoming, but maybe.
He frowns. The forelock flops.
Some guy called in about a chimney fire. I think it was after that. Pretty sure.
Anderson clicks, listens, shakes his head, clicks some more.
At last he gets a drawly farmer type who says he's seen a chimbley fire out on Farm Road 17.
Anderson gives Davis a thumbs up and goes to the next message. She has drawn up a chair next to him.
It sounds funny because...
Shh! Anderson draws a finger across his lips, zipping them shut. It does sound funny because the caller was using a voice-altering device, maybe a vocoder. It sounds like a man, then a woman, then a man again.
I love plain stress. I'm with the Kansas Highway Patrol. I'm not investigating the Yvonne Wicker murder, but I've seen the reports. Your readers might like to know the man who discovered the body is Daniel M. Coughlin. He's a janitor at Wilder High School. He lives in the Oak Grove Trailer Park.
I never printed the address, Anderson says. I thought that would be...
Shh! Go back.
Anderson flinches and does something with his mouse.
Wilder High School. He lives in the Oak Grove Trailer Park in the town of Manitou. You should print that right away.
There's a pause.
He is KBI's prime suspect because he claims he had a dream of where the body was. The investigators don't believe him. You might want to save that for a follow-up. Just a suggestion.
There's another pause. Then the vocoder voice says,
15. Goodbye.
There's a click, followed by someone who wants Plains Truth to know that July 4th festivities in Wilder County have been postponed until the 8th. Very sorry. Anderson kills the sound and looks at Davis.
Are you okay, ma'am?
Yes, she says. She's not. She's sick to her stomach. Play it again. She takes out her phone and hits record. 48. Back in her car, with the air conditioning on high, Davis listens to it again. Then she turns off her phone and stares through the windshield at Cathcart's dusty main street. She's thinking of an arson case she worked with Jobbert in the spring. It was in a rural town called Lindsborg. On their way to the site, they passed a field where a few cows were grazing. Ella, riding shotgun that day, counted them aloud just for something to do. 7, she said. 28, Jobbert replied with no pause. She gave him a questioning look, and he told her 1 to 7 added up to 28. He said adding inclusively passed the time and also kept him mentally sharp. She thought her partner might have a little touch of OCD. She'd even looked up the name of that particular compulsion on her phone, then dismissed it. Everyone had their little tics, didn't they? She herself couldn't go to sleep until all the dishes were washed and put away. But she had never considered counting them. Now sitting in her car, she thinks of Peter Anderson's outgoing message. 5 choices, and when you added 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the total was 15, she says. It was him. Fuck. Fuck. She sits a while longer, trying to convince herself that she's wrong. She can't do it. Absolutely can't. So she calls Troop C of the Kansas Highway Patrol, identifies herself, and asks for a callback from Trooper Calton as soon as possible. While she waits for the callback, which she dreads, she asks herself what she's going to do with what she now knows.
49. Danny gets all the empty boxes he wants at Manitou Fine Liquors.
He also gets a 5th of Jim Beam. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, the boxes are piled up in his bedroom, and the bottle of Beam is on the kitchen table. He sits there looking at it with his hands folded in front of him. He's trying to think of the last time he drank whiskey. Not on the night he got arrested for standing on Margie's lawn and shouting at her house. That night he'd been beered up. He'd downed almost a case of Coors between Manitou and Wichita. He could still remember vomiting it up into the stainless steel toilet of the cell they put him in, then going to sleep not on the bunk but underneath it, as if sleeping on concrete was some kind of penance. 50. He decides the last time he got into the high-tension stuff was fishing with Deke Mathers. The two of them were so loaded they didn't find their way out to Route 327 until it was almost dark. By then, both of them badly hung over and promising never again, never again. He didn't know how that had worked out with Deke. Danny had lost touch with him since moving to Oak Grove, but he hadn't touched brown liquor since. Not any beer for the last couple of years, either. Jim Beam won't solve his problems. He knows that. They'll still be there when he gets up on Tuesday morning, only with a hangover to add to his misery. But what it would do is to blot out DJ's sad face, at least for a while. She said, "What if Ma decides she wants Bobby for her boyfriend again?" She said, "He can't fix the car if it busts." She said, and somehow this was the worst of all. God knew why. "I don't want cake. I don't care if I ever have cake again." "That dream," he says. "That fucking goddamn dream." Only the dream isn't really the problem. Jalbert is the problem. Jalbert has sprayed his goddamn life with his version of Agent Orange. He's trying to poison everything, including a little girl who thought her life was pretty much okie-dokie. Her mom finally had a boyfriend Darla Jean liked who didn't shout and send her from the table without her supper. Jalbert. All Jalbert. Danny unscrews the cap, tips the bottle toward himself, takes a good long sniff. He remembers how he and Deke Mathers laughed there on the riverbank, everything fine. Then he remembers how they cursed as they shoved through that final blackberry tangle to the road, getting all scratched up and sweating into those scratches, making the sting even worse. "Jalbert would love you to get drunk," he thinks. "Get drunk and do something stupid." He goes into the bathroom, pours the whiskey into the toilet, and flushes it away. Then he starts packing his clothes into boxes. He can't beat Jalbert except by leaving, so that's what he's going to do. He'll get to spend time with Stevie, who knows where everything is in the Table Mesa King Supers. As for Darla Jean, she'll have to find her way. In the end, most kids do. So he tells himself. 50. "I'm not angry," Jalbert thinks as he drives back to his hotel in Lyons. "Just upset. The meeting in Wichita didn't go well. He argued for taking Coughlin in. 48 hours, he said. "We can call it protective custody. Just let me sweat him. I'll break him down. He's ready. I know it." Protective custody from who? That was Tishman, the director in charge. Neville, the assistant director, sat next to him, nodding like a puppet. The killer? Coughlin doesn't claim to know him. He only claims to know where the body was because of the dream he had. Jalbert asked those in attendance, including Ramsey, the stolid, closed-mouthed detective from Oklahoma, if any of them believed Coughlin's dream story. The unanimous belief was that no one did. Coughlin was the killer. But with no confession and no physical evidence tying him to the crime. And so on. Jalbert needs to do some counting. That would settle him. With a clear head, he'll be able to decide on his next move. When he gets back to the hotel, he'll run the chairs, take a shower, and call Ella. Maybe she's picked up a lead at the trailer park. Or possibly Coughlin has given something away, but probably not. He's a sly one. Got rid of the drugs, didn't he? But he's paying a price. He's out of a job, and his neighbors have turned against him. He's got to be angry, and angry people make mistakes. But I'm not angry, just upset. And why? Because he did it, and he'll do it again. "Don't they see that?" he asks, and bangs on the steering wheel. "Are they really that blind?" Answer, they are not. Every video feed between Arkansas City, where Miss Yvonne spent her last night,
and the gas and go where she was last seen has been checked. Several Tundras were spotted, but none were white and all were newer than Danny's. He used a different vehicle when he took her, Jobber thinks. That's why we didn't find any DNA or other evidence in his truck. Clever, so clever. Jalbert began, Ella did too, by believing that Danny wanted either to be a media star or to confess. Ella may still believe those things, but Jalbert no longer does. It's a game to him. He's sticking it in our faces and saying, prove it, prove it. Arrest me, ha ha, you can't, can you? You know my story's bullshit and there's not a damn thing you can do about it. Jalbert bangs the steering wheel again. 15 years ago, even 10, it was a different playing field with different rules. Coughlin would have been in a little room with Jalbert and Davis, and they'd sweat him until he gave it up. 10 hours, 12, it wouldn't matter. Turn and turn about, whap, whap, whap. They were advocates for poor Miss Yvonne and all the girls that might follow her. They'd go at him tirelessly in a room with no clock. You have to be hungry. Give us something and we'll send someone out for chow. You like Burger King? There's one right up the street. Whopper, fries, chocolate shake. How does that sound? At least tell us when you buried her. Day or night? No? Okay. Let's start again from the beginning. Like that. Jalbert begins counting barns and silos and farmhouses to pass the time. He's up to 23, which, added in arithmetical progression, totals 276, when his phone rings. It's Ella. He expects her to ask how it went in Wichita, but she doesn't. Instead, she asks when he expects to get back to his hotel. Her voice is clipped and tight. She hardly sounds like herself. Could it be excitement? Because she has something. Just a thread, that's all I ask. We'll follow it. We'll follow it all the way through hell, if that's what it takes. I should be there in 40 minutes. What have you got?
I'm on the road from Manitou now. I'll meet you there.
Come on, give! He runs his hand through the peninsula of his hair. Did Coughlin tell you something?
Not on the phone.
Make that half an hour, Jalbert says, and speeds up.
51. Ella is waiting in the lobby when Frank comes in.
She dreads the impending conversation, but will do what has to be done. It would be worse if she liked Frank. She's tried to do that and failed, but until the last couple of days, she respected him. In a way, she respects him still. He is fiercely dedicated to the job, to getting justice for the woman he calls poor Miss Yvonne. It's just that his dedication has crossed a line, and when it did, it turned into something else. He gives her a smile, showing those eroded teeth that really need caps. The thick triangle of his widow's peak is disarranged, as if he's been running a hand through it, perhaps pulling at it.
Let's go to my so-called suite. It's not great. The only view is of the parking lot, but it fits the expense account.
Ella follows. She doesn't know why he's formed such a fierce connection with the Wicker Girl. Or is it Coughlin he's made a connection with? But she knows it's put pressure on some fundamental crack in his personality. What was once a hairline is now a fissure. He unlocks the door. She goes in ahead of him and stops, looking around the suite's boxy little living room.
What's up with the folding chairs?
Nothing. Nothing.
He goes to the two in the living room and claps them shut. He goes into the bedroom and comes back with two more. He leans them against the wall beside the TV.
I have to take those back to the business center. Been meaning to. Want a soft drink? There's plenty in the minibar.
No, thank you.
Is it Coughlin? Did he let something slip?
I didn't talk to him.
Jalbert frowns.
I specifically asked you to re-interview him, Ella.
Then the frown lightens.
Was it Becky, the girlfriend? Or the daughter? Did she—
Listen, Frank.
There's no easy way to say this. You have to step away from the case. That's for starters. He's giving her a quizzical little smile. He has no idea what she's talking about. Then it's time for you to retire. You've got your 20 years, 20 and more.
I don't.
And get some professional help. The little smile is still there.
You're talking nonsense, Ella. I'm not going to retire. Not even thinking about it. What I'm going to do, what we're going to do, is collar Danny Coughlin and put him behind bars for the rest of his life.
She's surprised by fury, but later she'll think it was there all along. What you're doing is risking any chance we have of making a case against him. You outed him to Plain's truth, Frank.
The smile is fading.
What gave you that crazy idea?
It's not crazy. It's a fact.
You outed him, and you outed yourself with your counting thing. At the end of the message you left, you said 15. It had nothing to do with anything, except when you add the number of choices on the menu together. 1 to 5, you get 15.
Now the smile is gone. On the basis of one number, you jump to the conclusion that
sometimes a random number pops out of your mouth. Half the time you don't even know you're doing it. That's what happened on the recording Peter Anderson played for me. I heard it. You can hear it too if you want to. I've got it on my phone.
His lips part in a grin, showing those eroded teeth. He grinds them, she thinks. Of course he does.
I wouldn't want to report you for these false accusations, Ella. You've been a good partner. Couldn't ask for a better one. But if you persist, I'll have to. There's no way you could have recognized the voice that made that call, that anybody could recognize it, because it was disguised by some gadget.
Yes, it was. But how do you know that?
He blinks, and there's the briefest of hesitations. Then he says, because I asked him. Anderson. I interviewed him.
Not at any time when I was with you?
No, from here. On the phone.
Will he confirm that?
I'm confirming it to you right now.
Nevertheless, I'll ask him, if I have to. And we both know what he'll say, don't we?
Jalbert doesn't reply. He's looking at her as if she were a stranger. And probably right now, that's just how he feels.
She points to the chairs. Do you count those? Or maybe set them up and count the steps between them?
I think you better leave.
I see your lips moving sometimes when you're counting. There's even a name for it. Arithmomania.
Get out. Think about what you're saying, and we'll talk when you're not all wound up.
Davis is suddenly too tired to stand. Who knew how exhausting confrontations of this sort could be? She sits and puts her open purse on the little desk. Her phone is inside, recording.
You also planted drugs in Coughlin's truck at the high school.
He recoils as if she had struck at him with her fist.
That's an outrageous accusation.
It was outrageous that you did it. Coughlin got suspicious when the kid who works with him saw you park in back instead of in the faculty lot. Coughlin searched his truck, found the dope, and turned it over to me.
What? When?
I met him at a coffee shop in Great Bend after the meeting where he challenged us to arrest him, which we could not do then and can't now, as I'm sure you found out in Wichita.
He's a liar! And you went behind my back. Thanks, pardner.
She flushes. She can't help it. Jalbert is running his hands through his thick mat of receding hair.
If there were drugs in his truck, he planted them himself. He's sly. Oh boy, is he ever. And you actually believed his story.
Jalbert shakes his head. His tone is pitying. But what she sees in his eyes is bare, unvarnished fury.
Be careful of this man. She thinks. Danny was right about that.
I had no idea you were so credulous, Ella. Has he convinced you of his dream story, too? Are you on his side now?
I've spoken to Trooper Calton.
That stops him.
Coughlin saw his name tag. I called Calton and told him I knew who set up the plant and the search.
I said I'd keep his participation quiet if he told me what his role was. He did.
Jalbert goes to the window, looks out, then comes back to her. I didn't want him for the dope. I wanted him for Miss Yvonne. I wanted him locked up so I could turn the screws. Where's the dope now?
In a safe place. That last question is a tiny bit frightening. She doesn't really believe Frank would hurt her, but he's not right. There's no question of that. He goes to the window again and comes back again. His lips are moving. He's counting. Does he even know he's doing it? She doesn't think so.
He killed her. Raped her. And killed her, Coughlin. You know he did.
She thinks of Coughlin asking her about her cross. Did she wear it just for show? Or was she a believer? Then he asked her if she could believe in God, but not his dream. Frank, listen carefully. In this context, it no longer matters whether he killed her or not. Here in this room, all that matters is you telling me you're going to write an email to Don Tishman saying you need to take a leave of absence for personal reasons, and you're planning to retire.
Never.
He's clenching and unclenching his fists. Either that or I go to Tishman and tell him what you've done. The call to Anderson might not get you fired, but the dope thing certainly will. More, it will muddy up any case we might be able to make against Danny Coughlin so completely that even that small-town lawyer Ball could get him off.
You'd do that?
You did it! Davis cries, standing up. You screwed the case. You screwed yourself, and you screwed me as well. Look at the mess you made.
We can't let him get away, Jalbert says. He's looking around the room, eyes not settling anywhere. He did it.
If you believe that, don't fuck up any chance we have of nailing him. I'm leaving now. It's a big decision, I know. Sleep on it.
Sleep, he says and laughs. Sleep!
I'll call you tomorrow morning. See how you feel. But the choice is pretty clear, it seems to me. Step down, and we still have a chance of making a case against Coughlin. There'll be no nasty mess about planted evidence, and you get to keep your pension.
Do you think I care about my pension? He shouts. Cords stand out on his neck. Ella keeps her eyes locked on his. She's afraid to take them away.
You might not care about it now, in the heat of the moment, but you will later. And I know you still care about Yvonne Wicker. Think carefully, Frank. I'll let this slide if you step away, but it all comes out if you don't. And oy vey, the stench. She walks to the door. It's one of the longest walks of her life because she keeps expecting him to come after her. He doesn't. In the hallway, with the door closed, she lets out a breath she didn't know she was holding. She starts to zip her purse closed when from behind her comes a crash. Something just broke. Does she want to know what? She doesn't. Ella walks slowly and steadily down the hall. In her car, she lowers her head and cries. There was a moment there, just a moment, when she really thought he might kill her.
52. Franklin Jalbert has stayed in hundreds of motel rooms during his career as an investigator, crisscrossing Kansas from north to south and east to west. Almost all of those rooms come with plastic glasses in little baggies, mostly printed with slogans like "Sanitized for your safety." The glasses on top of the minibar of his little suite in the Celebration Center just happened to be real glass. He registers the weight of the one he's picked up before it's too late to stop. And he probably wouldn't have stopped anyway. He hurls it against the door Davis has just left, and it shatters. Better the glass than her, he thinks. Not that I would ever hurt her. Of course not. She may be a traitor, but they put in some good time together. Caught some bad boys and bad girls. He taught Ella, and she was eager to learn. Only she hasn't learned enough, it seems. She doesn't understand how dangerous Coughlin is. He wonders if perhaps after their traitorous meeting at the coffee shop, they might have gone somewhere else,
Maybe to a motel?
No, no. She'd never. Not with a prime suspect in a murder case.
Never? Really? Never? Coughlin's not a bad-looking man, and he has a wide-eyed, I'm-telling-the-truth look about him. Some might find that appealing. Is it really beyond the realm of possibility that she and he may be kind of a weird twist on the Stockholm syndrome? In spite of her backstabbing, he can't believe it of her. And never mind Ella. She's out of the picture. The question is what he's going to do about Coughlin. The answer seems to be nothing. She's put him in a box. That damned spineless trooper had to spill his guts, didn't he? The idea of retiring, as she suggested, is awful. Like being marched toward the edge of a cliff. He can't imagine stepping off into the void. He has no hobbies, except for the daily newspaper crossword and the occasional jigsaw puzzle. His vacations have consisted of aimless wanderings in a rented camper, seeing sights he doesn't care about and snapping pictures he rarely looks at later. Each hour feels 3 hours long. Retirement would multiply those long hours by 1,000, then 2,000, then 10,000. Each hour haunted by thoughts of Danny Coughlin looking at him across the table with that wide-eyed, wouldn't-hurt-a-fly gaze, saying, "Arrest me! You can't, can you?" Thoughts of Danny Coughlin stopping in some other state for another young girl with her thumb out and a pack on her back. And what can I do? Well, he can do one thing. Pick up the broken glass. He brings over a wastebasket, kneels down, and starts doing that. Pretty soon, he's up to 57 shards. 1,653 when added in progression. I wouldn't have hurt her. Absolutely not. But there was 1 second. Sharp pain needles the ball of his thumb. A bead of blood appears. Jalbert realizes he's lost count. He debates starting again from 1.
53. Danny Coughlin's last week in Manitou, Kansas is both sad and a relief. On Tuesday, he finds a big pile of dog shit in his mailbox. He dons a pair of his rubber work gloves, removes it, and washes the inner surface clean. Someone will want to use that mailbox after he's gone. On Wednesday, he goes to Food Town to pick up a few final supplies, including a steak he plans to eat on Friday night as a goodbye dinner. He's not in the market for long, but when he comes out, the two back tires of his truck are flat.
At least they're not punctured, he thinks, but probably just because whoever did it wasn't carrying a knife.
He calls Jesse because Jesse's number is in his contacts and he can't think of anyone else who might give him a help. Jesse says his dad left a lot of stuff when he ran out on his family, and one of those things was a Hospel tire inflator. Give me 20 minutes, he says. While Danny waits, he stands beside his truck and collects dirty looks. Jesse arrives in his beat-up Caprice, and the Tundra's back tires are good to go in no time. Danny thanks him, alarmed to feel tears threatening.
No problem, Jesse says and holds out his hand. Listen, man, I gotta say it again. I know you didn't kill that girl.
Thanks for that, too. How's the sawmill? I was driving by and saw you hauling lumber in a short box.
Jesse shrugs. It's a paycheck. What's up with you, Danny? What's next?
Getting out of town this weekend. I'm thinking Nederland to start with. I'll camp out, I've got some gear, and look for a job. And a place.
Jesse sighs. Probably for the best, the way things are. Shoot me a text when you get someplace.
He gives Danny a shy look that's all 17.
You know, stay in touch.
I'll do that, Danny says. Don't cut off any fingers at that mill. Jesse flashes a grin. Got the same advice from my mom's. She says I'm the man of the house now.
On Thursday, most of his stuff packed and ready to go. The trailer looking nude somehow. He gets a call from Edgar Ball while he's drinking his first cup of coffee.
Ball says, I have bad news, good news, and really good news. At least I think it is. Which do you want first?
Danny sets his cup down with a bang. Did they catch him? The guy who killed her?
Not that good, I'm afraid, Ball says. The bad news is that it's not just Plains Truce anymore. You're in the Telescope, the Wichita Eagle, the Kansas City Star, and the Oklahoman, along with your picture.
Fuck, Danny says.
The good news is the picture they're running has to be 10 years old. You've got hair down to your shoulders and a biker stash. Looks like you're standing in front of a bar, but I might only think that because you're holding up a bottle of beer in each hand.
Probably the Golden Rope in Kingman. Before I married Margie, I used to do a lot of drinking there. I think it burned down.
Don't know about that, Ball says cheerfully. But that photo doesn't look anything like you now. You ready for the best news?
Lay it on me.
It came from a friend who's a clerk in Troop F of the Highway Patrol. That's in Kichai, near Wichita. I used to date the lady in question, but that was in another life. She knows you retained me. She called last night and said Frank Jalbert is taking a leave of absence. Rumor is he's going to retire.
Danny feels a big grin break over his face. It's the first real one since he woke up after that fucking dream. Jalbert has haunted his thoughts. Not even talking to Stevie can get the inspector entirely out of his mind. He reminds Danny of some animal, maybe a wolverine, that supposedly won't unclamp its jaws from whatever it's bitten even after it's dead. That really is good news.
Want to go out to Dabney's to celebrate? Big breakfast, I'm buying.
Dabney's is two towns over and should be safe enough, especially if the picture the newspapers are running is from the days when Danny wanted to look like Lonesome Dave Peverett from Foghat. Sounds good. I might bring a friend, the kid I used to work with. But Jesse says he can't, as much as he'd like to. He punches in at 8.
Also, my mom was pretty mad that I went out to help you yesterday. I told her you didn't do what they were saying, and she said that didn't matter because I was a young black man, and you were, you know, a white man accused of murder, Danny says.
I get it.
Well, yeah. But I'd go anyway if I didn't have to work.
I appreciate that, Jess, but your mom is probably right. He goes out to Dabney's. Ball is there. They order huge breakfasts and eat every bite. Danny offers to split the check, but Ball won't hear of it. He asks Danny what comes next for him. Danny tells him about his plan to go to Colorado to be near his brother, who's on the spectrum but has a gift a psychologist who examined him in his late teens called global recognition. Basically, he sees where everything is. They talk about that for a while.
Got something in mind, Ball says as they leave the restaurant. I've been thinking about it ever since our first go-round with that hairball Jalbert. But then I got reading the comments in the Eagle and the Telescope, and I thought, yeah, maybe, might work.
I have no idea what you're talking about. What comments?
I guess you don't read them. It's the equivalent of letters to the editor in the old days. After you finish reading the story, you can comment on it. There are lots of comments on the stories about you.
Hang him fast and hang him high, Danny says.
There are some like that, sure, but you'd be surprised how many people believe you actually did dream where the body was. Everyone, those that believe you, I mean, has a story about how their grandma knew the propane was going to explode and got everyone out of the house, or that the plane was going to crash, so they took a later flight.
Those are premonitory dreams, Danny says. He's done some reading. Not the same.
Yes, but there are also comments from people who dream the location of a lost ring, or a lost dog, or in one case, a missing kid. This woman claims she dreamed a neighbor boy fell down an old well, and there he was. It's not just you, Danny. And people love stuff like that because it gives them the idea that there's more to the world than we know. He pauses. Of course, there are also people who think you're so full of shit you squeak. That makes Danny laugh.
At Danny's truck, Ball says,
okay, so here's what I'm thinking. It might be a way to get a little money, but that's really secondary. It would be a way to fight back.
You're thinking...
What? Filing a lawsuit. Exactly. For harassment. Someone hucked a brick at your trailer, right?
Right.
Dog shit in your mailbox? Let the air out of your tires?
Pretty thin, Danny says. And I thought cops were protected from that sort of thing. Jalbert may retire, but he was a cop in good standing when he came after me.
Ah, but he planted drugs on you, Ball says. And if we can get the cop who rousted you in court and under oath, can we go back to your trailer and talk about it? I mean, what else have you got to do?
Not much, Danny admits. Sure, I guess we could talk about it. He drives back to Oak Grove with Ball behind him on his Honda.
Danny pulls up at his trailer and sees someone sitting on the concrete block steps, head down, hands dangling between his knees. Danny gets out of his truck, closes the door, and for a moment just stands there, struck by deja vu, almost overwhelmed by it. His visitor is wearing a high school letter jacket. Where has he seen that before?
Ball's Honda Goldwing pulls up behind his truck. The kid stands up and raises his head. Then Danny knows. It's the kid from the newspaper photo. The one standing in front of the hearse and behind his grief-stricken parents.
Bastard, you killed my sis,
the kid says. He reaches into the right pocket of his leather jacket and brings out a revolver. Behind Danny, the gold wing shuts off and Ball dismounts, but that's in another universe.
Whoa, son, I didn't...
That's as far as he gets before the kid fires. A fist hits Danny in the midsection. He takes a step back and then the pain comes, like the worst acid indigestion attack he ever had. The pain goes up to his throat and down to his thighs. He gropes behind him for the door handle of his Tundra and can barely feel it when he finds it. His legs are getting loopy. He tells them not to buckle. Warmth is running down his stomach. His shirt and jeans are turning red.
Hey! Ball shouts from that other universe. Hey! Gun!
No shit, Danny thinks. With his weight to pull at, the driver's door of the Tundra swings open. Danny doesn't fall where he stands only because he opened his window on the way back from Dabney's. The morning air was so cool and fresh. That seems like another lifetime. He hooks his elbow through the window and around the doorpost and pivots like a stripper on a pole. The kid fires again and there's a plung sound as the bullet hits the door below the open window.
Gun! Gun!
Edgar Ball is shouting. The next bullet goes through the open window and buzzes past Danny's right ear. He sees the kid's cheeks are wet with tears. He sees Althea Dumfries standing on the top of her trailer. Fanciest one in the park, Danny thinks. Crazy what goes through your head when you're shot. She appears to be holding a piece of toast with a bite out of it. Danny goes to his knees. The pain in his abdomen is excruciating. He hears another plung as another bullet strikes the Tundra's open door. Then he's all the way down. He can see the kid's feet. He's wearing Converse sneakers. Danny sees the gun when the kid drops it on the ground. Ball is still yelling. Ball is bawling, he thinks. And then the world slides into darkness.
54.
He comes to on a stretcher. Edgar Ball is looking down at him, eyes wide. There's dirt smeared on his cheeks and forehead. He's saying something. It might be, "Hang in there, buddy." And then the stretcher bumps something and the pain explodes. The pain becomes the world. Danny tries to scream and can only moan. For a moment, there's sky, then a roof above him. And he thinks, it might be an ambulance. How did it get here so fast? How long was I out?
Someone says, a little pinch, and then you'll feel better. There's a pinch. Darkness follows.
55.
When it goes away, he sees lights sliding by above him. It's like a shot in a movie. A loudspeaker calls for Dr. Broder.
Dr. Broder, stat,
it says. Danny tries to speak, tries to say, is it the good doctor? The one on TV? Just as a joke. He knows better, but all that comes out are a few muffled sounds because he's got some kind of a mask over his mouth and nose. Doors bang open. There are brighter lights and green tile walls. He supposes it's an operating room, and he wants to say he doesn't know if he can afford an operation because he lost his job. Hands hoist him, and oh, Jesus, Savior, it hurts. There's a pinch. Darkness follows. 56. Now he's in a bed. Has to be a hospital bed. There's light, but not the cruel we're-going-to-cut-you-open light shining down in that green room. No, this is daylight. Margie, his ex, is sitting by his bed. She's all dolled up, and Danny knows that if she dressed up for him, he's probably going to die. His midsection is stiff. Stiff as a plank. Bandages, maybe. And there's an IV hanging on a hook, and he thinks, if they're putting stuff into me, maybe I'm not going to die. Margie asks, how do you feel, Dano? Like in the old days when they still got along. Like, book 'em, Dano. And he tries to answer, but can't. Darkness. 57. He opens his eyes, and Edgar Ball is sitting by his bed. No dirt on his face, so he must have cleaned up. How much time has passed? Danny has no idea.
Close call, but you're going to pull through, Ball tells him.
And Danny thinks, that's what they all say. On the other hand, maybe it's the truth.
Good thing you got behind the truck door. If he'd been shooting a larger caliber gun, the bullets would have gone right through, but it was a .32.
Kid, he manages.
Albert Wicker, Ball says. Yvonne Wicker's brother.
I knew that, Danny tries to say. Fired 3 or 4 times, dropped the gun, walked right past me. Went out to the street and sat down on the curb and waited for the cops. In a movie, I would have tackled him. But the truth is, I face-planted beside my motorcycle at the first gunshot. Sorry. Okay, Danny says. You. Okay.
Thanks for saying that. We've got a real suit now, Danny. Soon as you get better.
Danny tries to smile. He closes his eyes. Darkness. 58. Is it Jesse next time? Or a dream? They're giving him a lot of dope, so he can't be sure. But he's positive, almost positive, that he sees a dark brown hand over his white one. 59. Next time he surfaces, it's Ella Davis. He's a little stronger, and she looks a little younger in faded jeans and a boat neck tee. Her hair is down, and she is smiling. Danny, are you awake?
Yes, a bear croak. Water. Is there...
She holds a glass for him. There's a bindi straw sticking out of it. He drinks, and it's heaven on his throat. Danny, we got him.
The kid?
His voice is a little stronger.
I think Edgar told the cops.
Not the kid. Him. The man who killed Yvonne Wicker. He... Are you getting this? Do you understand what I'm telling you?
Yes.
Does he feel relieved? Vindicated? He can't tell. He's not even sure how badly he's hurt or if he'll ever be really well again. What if he has to spend the rest of his life shitting into a bag?
He's confessed, Danny. Confessed to Wicker and 2 others. Cops in Illinois and Missouri
are looking for the bodies. All right, Danny says. He's very tired. He wants her to go. I went to Mass and prayed for you. It helps if you believe, Danny says. He feels her take his hand, her skin cool on his. He thinks he should tell her he doesn't blame her. But the very idea of blame seems pointless right now. He turns his head, floats away. Darkness. 60. By the third day, he hurts bad, but he's back in the world. He understands he's at Regional Hospital in Great Bend, and he's going to be here at least a week, maybe 10 days. The bullet perforated his stomach. He's been repaired and sewed up, but Broder, the doctor in charge of his case, says if he tries to walk even to the bathroom, he's apt to open it up again.
Be grateful it wasn't a soft-nosed slug and a bigger caliber. That would have done a lot of damage. You'll be on soft food for a while. I hope you like scrambled eggs and yogurt.
Being in bed means the bedpan, but the indignity of that is mitigated by the fact that he's been spared the catheter and colostomy bag. He learns that Margie was allowed to see him early on because she claimed to be his wife, which wasn't true. Edgar Ball was allowed to see him because he claimed to be his lawyer, which was. Ella Davis was also allowed in because she was a KBI officer and because she said she had good news to share. Very good. And Jesse? That might have been a drug-induced hallucination, but Danny doesn't believe it. He thinks Jesse slipped in somehow and took his hand. At some point he'll have to ask him. Stevie doesn't know, and that's good. It would upset him. Danny will have to tell him at some point, but that's for later. Late in the afternoon of his fourth day at the hospital, he's allowed to sit by the window in his room, 2 steps, supported by a pair of orderlies. While he's enjoying the feel of the sun on his face, Edgar Ball comes to see him again. He sits on the bed and asks Danny how he feels. Not bad. The dope is primo.
What do you want to know?
Everything.
That will strain my powers of condensation. They're only giving me 20 minutes. Then they have to put you back to bed and irrigate you.
Ball grimaces.
I don't even want to know what that entails.
Davis told me they caught the guy who killed Yvonne Wicker, but I passed out before she could give me any details. Start there.
His name? Is Andrew Iverson, no fixed address, an itinerant Mr. Fix-It. He was heading west, driving a little blue panel truck with Andy I, Plumbing and Heating, on the side. It showed up on a video both in Arkansas City, where Wicker last stayed, and at the Gas and Go, where she was last spotted. He's also on video in Great Bend, Manitou, and Cawker City.
Cawker's close to Dart County, isn't it?
Yes. Wicker was probably dead in the back of his truck when he drove through there. He was looking for a lonely spot to bury her.
And found one.
Iverson's picture should be in the encyclopedia next to the entry for serial killers. He drives, stops for a while, does some business. Cash only, he told the cops, because he says cash don't tell.
You got this from Davis?
Yes, we had a long talk. She feels terrible about this whole business.
She's not the only one, Danny thinks.
Iverson killed a girl in Illinois and another in Missouri. Buried them in rural locations. The cops have found one. They're still looking for the other. He picked up a 4th girl hitchhiking in Wyoming, outside a little town called Glen Rock. He pulled over on some country road and tried to rape her. She had a knife in her boot. While he was getting his pants down, she stabbed him 4 times.
Good for her, Danny says. He thinks of the dog that was chewing on Yvonne Wicker's arm. Goddamn good for her.
Davis says this was one tough chick. She tumbled him out of the van, drove toward Casper until she had a cell signal, and called the police. He wasn't where the girl said he was, but they followed a blood trail to a nearby barn. He was in a horse stall. Passed out from blood loss.
Davis says he's going to recover.
He confessed? She told me he confessed, unless I dreamed that part.
You didn't. Wounds hurt, as I think you know. You got shot once. Iverson got stabbed 4 times. Once in the cheek, once in the shoulder, once in the side, and once in the leg. He wanted painkillers. The cops wanted information. They both got what they wanted.
Davis told you all that?
She did, and asked me to tell you. I think she's afraid to face you again.
I get that. But I guess in the end she did her job.
She stood up to Jalbert, if that's what you mean, but that's a story for another day. My 20 minutes are almost up. Do you remember the charm bracelet the Wicker girl was wearing?
Danny remembers. He saw it twice, once in his dream and once in real life.
Iverson had 2 of the charms in his kill sack, as trophies. There was more stuff in there, from the other 2.
Where's the kid that shot me?
Albert Wicker is in a Manitou motel with his folks. He made bail, or rather his parents did. I know the lawyer who represented him at his arraignment. He says the Wickers mortgaged their house to come up with the money.
Danny thinks about that. Daughter dead, son facing attempted murder charges. Parents probably facing bankruptcy. And I'm in the hospital with a hole in my stomach, Danny thinks. The wandering plumber did a lot of damage, and that's just the spreading circle of pain around the young woman Jalbert insisted on calling poor Miss Yvonne. Danny wishes the girl who got away, the fabled last girl, had stabbed Iverson in the balls for good measure.
I don't want to press charges, Danny says.
Edgar Ball smiles. Am I surprised? I am not. But it's not entirely up to you. Wicker will do some time, but considering the mitigating circumstances, it may not be much.
A nurse pokes her head in the door.
Sir, you need to let my good pal Danny rest. Plus he needs some services you won't want to be around for.
Irrigation, Danny says glumly. This doesn't happen when someone gets shot on TV.
5 more minutes, Ball says. Please.
You can have 3, the nurse says, and leaves.
I had a meeting with Don Tishman, who was technically in charge of the KBI investigation. I laid out the facts of the matter concerning Jalbert, but felt it would be smart to withhold the name of the trooper who stopped you and look for drugs.
For a small-town lawyer who specializes in real estate contracts, you've been pretty busy. Danny means it lightly, almost as a joke, but Ball flushes and looks down at his hands.
I should have tackled that kid. I could have. He was totally focused on you. Instead, I went face down in the dirt.
Danny repeats that it's not like TV. Ball raises his head.
Understood. But I don't have to like it. No man wants to think he's a coward, especially one that rides a badass bike.
I wouldn't call a Honda Goldwing badass, Edgar. A Harley Softail, that's badass.
Be that as it may, we've reached an accommodation, I think. A few details still to be worked out, but yes, it looks good. In exchange for keeping quiet about Jalbert, who has indeed put in his retirement papers, you're going to have your medical bills paid by the Sunflower State and with a certain sum left over. Not huge, but tidy. 5 figures. It will get you relocated in Colorado if you still decide to go.
The nurse doesn't just poke her head in this time. She points at Ball.
Not asking, telling. Going, Ball says and gets up. You can have your job back, you know, once you're well enough to do it.
Good to know, Danny says. He has no intention of staying. Someone threw a brick at his trailer. Someone put shit in his mailbox. Bill Dumfries basically told him on behalf of the good people of Oak Grove to get out of Dodge. What weighs against those things is Darla Jean, sitting in the dirt next to her dollhouse with tears rolling down her cheeks. But he doesn't think it weighs enough to tip the scales. He has a brother in Colorado. And if getting shot does nothing else,
It gives you insight into how short the time is you have to spend with your loved ones.
All because of one dream, he says bitterly. It didn't even help catch the guy.
But think of the adventure you had.
Danny shows him a middle finger.
On that note, Ball says, and takes his leave.
61. While Albert Wicker is spending his first afternoon in the Wilder County Jail, hardly aware of what he did, the last few days are a blur, that morning hardly there at all. Franklin Jalbert is sitting in his dining room, in his bathrobe, doing a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. When completed, it will show a collage of movie posters. Classics like Casablanca, It's a Wonderful Life, Jaws, 2 dozen in all. Jalbert keeps track of how many pieces he's put in. After 10 pieces, he takes one step, in place, as if marching, so he can sit down again. After 20, he takes 2, one out from his chair and one back. He's up to 800 pieces, almost done, when his phone rings. He looks at the screen and sees H. Allard. Hank Allard is a friend of his, a captain in the Kansas Highway Patrol. Jalbert is torn between answering and doing the next set of steps, which would be 1 to 80 inclusive. He decides on the steps. 3,240. Quite a lot. He starts at 80 and counts in reverse. The steps take him outside to the small backyard of his ranchette and back again. He sees that previous trips have made a path in the grass, a rut, in fact. He's aware that the step counting thing, and running the chairs, that too, has gotten even more out of control since his failure to arrest Danny Coughlin. Davis called it arithmomania. While doing the steps associated with his jigsaw puzzle, Jalbert often thinks he's like a hamster running on a wheel, going and going, shitting on the run and never getting anywhere. But that's all right. What Davis couldn't realize is that this minor craziness keeps him from the greater craziness of contemplating a future from which his job has been subtracted. How many jigsaw puzzles can he do before facing the pointlessness of his life going forward and slides his service weapon deep into his mouth? Boom. Gone. God knows he wouldn't be the first. God knows he's thought about it. Is thinking. He comes back to the steps when he's down to 5. By the time he gets to 0, he's in the kitchen. Time for another 10 pieces, and then he'll count down from 81. Possibly first by odd numbers, then doing the even ones. After that, it will be time for lunch and a nap. He loves his naps. Such smooth oblivion. His phone is beside the mostly completed jigsaw puzzle. He's currently assembling the 10 Commandments, which he most definitely doesn't consider a classic. Hank Allard has left a voicemail, and he sounds excited.
Call me. I've got news. You'll want to hear.
Jalbert can't imagine any news he wants to hear, but he returns the call. Allard answers on the first ring and wastes no time.
Your boy Coughlin has been shot.
What? Jalbert stands up, giving the table a hard bump and sliding the nearly completed puzzle almost to the edge. Several pieces patter to the floor. Allard laughs.
The Wicker girl's brother shot the motherfucker. You want to talk about justice? Whoop, there it is.
Is he dead?
We can hope. The first trooper to respond to the scene said there was a lot of blood and several bullet holes in the bastard's truck. They took him to regional in an ambulance instead of treating him at that little excuse for a hospital in Manitou, so it was bad. Maybe he died on the way.
Jalbert shakes a fist at the ceiling, thinking, closure, sweet closure. God did what I couldn't. His voice isn't quite steady.
I wouldn't disagree,
Allard says. Keep me informed. You know I'm out of the loop.
Which is one more fucked up thing in a fucked up world, Allard says. You bet I will.
That night, Jalbert goes out to Bullwinkle's and gets drunk for the first time in 20 years. He does not count steps, which is a relief.
Counting steps and running chairs is hard work. So many numbers to keep track of. So easy to lose count. He supposes nobody would believe that, but it's the truth. If you lose count, you have to start over. While Jalbert is drinking his second whiskey and soda, Allard calls again. Jalbert has to shout because of the combined roar of the TV, the jukebox, and a bunch of unwinding KU summer students.
Is he dead? No. Serious condition. Shot in the stomach.
Jalbert first feels disappointed, then happy. Isn't that better than life in prison, where Coughlin would get 3 meals a day, a TV in his cell, and time in the exercise yard? It hurts to get shot in the gut.